Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, WCTCAM.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm disturbed.
Yes, you are. But
yeah, that's good. You know, I was disturbed because I almost hate to do this, but I feel obligated to.
Francis and I get a lot of books and papers and magazines and things to review in order to, A, be up on things that are for the show, but also to possibly have guests.
Well, and for books that sort of come to us unsolicited, they go to our producer, Sherry, very able producer, and she's pretty good at deciding what should to pass on to us and what not to, but every once in a while, once a week, we get a stack of books on our desk with a post-it note that says, are you interested in these? And I got a series of books. One is called Pizza, A Global History. Two is called Hamburger, A Global History. And three is called Pancake, A Global History by three different authors. They're all in the same book jacket, and they're in the Edible series. Beyond that, I don't know much about them. You never know. I may turn around and like these books, but
at first glance, we were not impressed.
Probably not gonna, based on my first interaction.
So what happened in your first interaction, Francis?
Well, I lost the page here, but I have a I popped it to page 74 just to say, okay, well, pizza, the history of pizza, that could be an interesting thing. Let me just read to you. This chapter 3, The Little Meal That Could, Pizza's Conquest of the World. In the United States, pizza fans maintain that the Italians may have brought pizza to the States, but America introduced it to the rest of the world. The kind of pizza that Americans introduced to the world was standardized pizza. Now, if I'm writing this paragraph, bad things.
But there are still some great pizza out there.
Right, exactly. The kind of pizza that Americans introduced to the world is standardized pizza, popularized by franchise restaurants like Pizza Hut and Domino's. Standardized pizza is a far cry from the handcrafted pizza found in Naples. Again, a setup for bad things that I'm writing the paragraph. But here we go, and I'm gonna excerpt this a little bit. Standardized pizza is large. Okay. That's an advantage.
It's standardized.
It's meant to be. So are Americans. That's what, and why? Maybe it's because our pizzas are so large. Look at the Neapolitans. They're not very large. Okay. It's meant to be consumed by several people at once. Standardized pizza comes in slices. It's meant to be eaten with your hands. Even the pan pizzas from Pizza Hut are cut into tiny quadrants. And despite the marketing campaigns touting crisp crust, standardized pizza tends to be softer because it's baked in pans, on racks, and in a steel pizza oven. That's not a good thing. That's not a good thing. Here's more of the advantages of standardized pizza. More often than not, standardized pizza is delivered. It's meant to be eaten at home according to the consumer's desire, craving, or convenience. And I might add, bad taste.
Well, we all eat pizza at home sometimes.
I eat pizza at home, and I eat standardized pizza, too. I'm just saying that let's not celebrate the fact. I'm a little ashamed every time I do that. It's weak. I'm weak. Actually, there's a great pizzeria in Metuchen, New Jersey, and I wish I could remember the name of it. I'd give them a plug. But I've got their number on my refrigerator.
Well done. I will tell you, though, Francis, we have a good friend. Her name's Mary. And, you know, she has a maxim, and that particular maxim is... And it's taken from another maxim, but it's based maximum. It's taken from another maxim, but which you might recognize when I tell you. But what she said is, even bad pizza is good pizza.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I actually don't agree with that, because some of those big chain pizzas, I just think I would rather eat a shoe. Okay, but
I just the big chain pizzas. I don't. It's not really worth it.
I mean,
really
even
it's not worth the calories. That's for sure.
Yeah, but there are standardized pizzerias in every town across this country.
But look at
Domino's. They buy soda and they buy sauce from a can, and they buy mozzarella from a bag.
But somehow Domino's is worse.
And you're right. I cannot disagree. Domino's is my and I can't get sued for this because I really believe it. Domino's is my least favorite pizza, except for Little Caesars, which is also to me the worst of the worst.
But you know, it's funny. You go out into some culinary wastelands in the middle of the country, and that's
the only choice.
Know.
That's
and,
the only choice.
You and I grew up with. I mean, there was Bonavini's Pizza in Livingston. Patty Bonavini was in my third grade class, and every
Scotto's.
Time.
Scotto's. I was a Scotto's guy.
Oh, yeah, but was Scotto in your grammar school?
No, Scotto's was actually in Clifton. People in Nutley don't like to talk about that. Scotto's was just across the border.
It's Nutley's favorite son pizzeria, and it's in Clifton.
But it was there was a real Nutley war too. The Scotto's versus the Ralph's.
I read about that. That was in the paper.
Two very different kinds of pizzas, and we
thick crust, thin crust. What was the Ralph's?
The Ralph's was a thin crust, kind of wasn't very good. It was for the people who weren't really Italian.
You know,
Scotto's had more tomato-y flavor to it. It was
We had a Star Tavern in Orange where I've taken you. Star Tavern in Orange, New Jersey. It's kind of a rough neighborhood, but there's a policeman stationed outside every night in a police car. And it's wonderful pizza, but it doesn't travel well. I mean, they don't deliver. And they don't deliver because the pizza doesn't travel. And I respect them for that. It's a pub. It's a family restaurant. And the thing to get there is the plain pizza, as you've discovered. I know you like stuff on your pizza, but with Star Tavern, very thin crust. And it's got to come right out of the oven, come right to your table. You put it in a box, and it tastes like the box. But I just want to I want to say one thing.
Which, so in essence, it tastes like Domino's, though, as soon as you put it in the box.
Well, but here's the thing about standardized pizza. Patty Bonavini, sadly, that pizzeria closed in Livingston. Bonavini's Pizza was really great thin crust pizza. Patty Bonavini was in my class. Every other kid's birthday, on their birthday, you get cupcakes. Patty's birthday, her dad brought pizza. How popular was she? I wanted to marry her. Let me just finish in this book. Standardized pizza is frequently criticized because it's well standardized. Your extra cheese pizza in Chicago will look the same as your extra cheese pizza in Sydney. Culinary conservatives appreciate this consistency because there's something reliable about pizza from a chain restaurant. You know exactly what you're getting when you order it. I don't think we have to have the author of this book on the show. I think the author of this book would not want to come on our show.
No, it would be a tough couple of minutes for him.
Patty Bonavini, I don't know if you knew how much joy you brought to my grammar school.
If you're listening, Patty, you should call Francis.
That was great. Terrific.
And tell him he's welcome.
All right, well, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk with Pat Willard about her book, America Eats, which is a collection of stories that comes from the WPA about what American food looked like in the Great Depression. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking, rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the 7 most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolite? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest today is Pat Willard. She's the author of 3 books about food. Pie Every Day was cited by Atlantic Monthly, Bon Appetit, and Amazon as among the top 10 cookbooks of 1997. A Soothing Broth came out in 1999. And the book we're talking about today mostly is called America Eats. It's based on work done for the WPA in the 1930s.
Hey, Pat, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So this isn't really a cookbook we're talking about, America Eats. This is a book about the history of American food, right?
Right, exactly.
Well, talk to us about what did the WPA have to do with food? We know that they went out and we built bridges and we commissioned artists and authors and painters. What did the WPA do with food? I was unfamiliar until I read your book with that.
Well, you know, they had this project where they were putting all these people back to work during the Great Depression, and one big group was, you know, writers, and they had to find projects for them. So they did tour books and looked at different ways that American people came together, such as slavery and how we worked and people at work. And then they had this bright idea that one of the subjects that has never been fully explored was how American food came together. And so with this army of people across the country, the editors in Washington decided that it would be kind of a cool thing to go out and explore what I call the narrative arc of how our food came together from from the first immigrants, the pilgrims, and how they had to blend together with the Indians and so on, and how we developed our food from those meager beginnings.
Well, Pat, I have to say one of the things I really enjoyed about the book is so many recipe books now are using stories to contextualize the recipes.
Right.
In your book, you're using recipes to contextualize your stories, which I thought was kind of cool.
Well, I'm always backwards. But, it was intriguing to see that the WPA writers were on the forefront of telling stories to explore how food came together. So they were before their time in that way. And then the dishes that they picked out were trying to show exactly what the different influences were in particular regions. So for instance, they would, of course, go down the south and look at how lard is being used and how their barbecue sauces are tomato-based as opposed to spice-based. And so they really got into the recipes in a really interesting way.
Well, I think one of the interesting things we talk about or that appears in your book is it's not so much, I didn't read it so much as a history of how food came together in the United States,
right,
as to how food brought people together in various communities in the United States.
Right. Food was, and this is kind of one of the cool things I think about our food in general that we always have to keep in mind. Our food was one of the primary ways in which the country came together as a united country. So, you know, if you think about it, we were, tons of different people from so many different nationalities and experiences arriving here, and one of our big challenges was to make us all citizens. So one of the ways that people started from the get-go, because you have to eat, is to sit down at a table together and kind of share the experience of living out in the forest or the wilderness and making food out of what you find. So a lot of different ideas about food got blended together. You know, at a table you could have an Irish person, an English lord, Spanish conquistador, and some Indians, and unfortunately some slaves. And, you know, the food that was all being mixed together came from those different influences.
But with what was around them at that time.
Yeah, I mean, this experience is happening even today. If you think of people coming to this country for the first time and deciding to make their living, then they go to the grocery store and they're looking for familiar ingredients to make the dishes that they grew up with. That's exactly the same experience that our forefathers did. I mean, obviously much humbler. They had to go out to the forest and find these things where, you know, new immigrants go to the supermarket. But it's the same kind of looking for something to make what they know, and through that, something transforms, something happens, so that the original cultural meals become an American meal, if that makes sense. And that's the heart of the WPA papers.
Well, and it's not just that. You know, you one culture might go out and forage for mushrooms, while another one use nuts and berries that another culture might not use as much.
And that's kind of what you can see in what I consider like our big pot dishes, the Brunswick stews and the bouillas and the Burgoo stews, where you have a big pot and different people would put ingredients in, and out would come this sort of unique dish. So
Brunswick stew. In your book, there's a lot of talk about how it's not really a Brunswick stew unless there's a significant amount of squirrel.
Yes.
You know, when I was a kid, I used to go hunting with my dad, and we used to eat squirrel because, well, we weren't very good hunters. That was mostly what we got. But it's
squirrels work right up to you.
Not out in the woods. Not out in the woods in far North Jersey where you know you've got a shotgun. They get smart up there. So talk to us about that.
About Brunswick stew.
Well, about Brunswick stew, and I think it's an interesting thing to talk about how. You know, there's the classic way to make a dish, but that's, you know, the sure way to start an argument is to talk about the classic way to make a classic dish.
Yeah, and, you know, this is for a country that's not known to be ardent about food. I mean, you ask a couple of people between Virginia and Georgia how to make Brunswick stew, and, you know, there's all hell breaks loose. Brunswick stew was really a frontier dish. It was usually made in the fall around harvest time to... say thank you for all the people who would come to your farm. And so they use the ingredients that are around in the fall. And squirrel was definitely up there because the poor little things were out there gathering their nuts. So they would have squirrel, and they would have the corn from their harvest, tomatoes, and they would throw a chicken in for the broth, and then whatever spices they had. The original recipe is not that heavy on spices. But as you go down south further and you get the influences of African Americans and a lot of other groups, you start seeing a lot more spicy Brunswick stew happening.
Now, that brings us to another interesting point in your book and how you've collected these papers that were originally collected for the WPA. There are, you know, you talk about being a unified nation, but I think what's more interesting is that there are regional differences and that people come together in regions, and there are things that are more regional strengths and similarities,
right,
than there is in national cuisine.
Right.
But the glaring exception to that is touched upon in your book several times is there's often at these culinary events that bring a community together. The great divide, of course, was there was in any particular region, there was the black community and the white community, and
right,
the food was different, and the event that you would go to, you know, there wasn't a lot of, in a lot of the country, there wasn't a lot of, the blacks and whites sitting down at tables together at community fish fries.
Right, right. Not at that time. And the people, the original papers really show the social divide at that time and what people thought of it, thought of different groups. So most of the papers running through it, there's a real strong, what I would consider a white Protestant kind of thing going on. And then they tried to look at, they had huge arguments about what was an American dish, and for the different pockets of immigrants, they would have, the writers would go out and find these different dishes, and the editors would say, well, that's not American. Like, so they ran into a whole lot of trouble, for instance, in the Midwest, where there was a lot of Scandinavian and German dishes that were very regional that lots of people knew about, and yet the editors in Washington were saying, well, that's not American enough.
Now, the book eventually, that sort of was one of the things that led to the book never really got published back in its day. All this work was done, all these writers were put to work collecting these things, yet the book was never published by the WPA.
Well, a lot of that had to do with basically the Congress never really liking the WPA and thinking, particularly the writers' part of it, as a hotbed of communists. So they were really ready to pull the plug on it. But the big thing that killed it was our entry into World War II. And it's a shame because the papers were just about ready to be – the final editings were in place.
No, but you mentioned in your book that the final editings were a real hatchet job, I think.
Oh, my God, yeah.
What happened?
Well, it's what happens when you send a whole bunch of writers out. I mean, you know, you have these writers, and they're all going out finding these great stories. And basically, the editors only wanted the essence of their story. So they just wanted to know what dishes were around and how they're being used.
Wanted to conform to a certain style.
Exactly. And, you know, you just can't conform writers to a style. You know, so all their wonderful stories that they came back with, and so, some of them are so eloquent and funny, were being cut.
Well, it's funny, you know, that as Mark talked about at the beginning of our program this afternoon, the people who put this project together and collected the writers to make this book sent out people to write America's story through food, not necessarily just to collect recipes, which is indeed a type of book that has a lot of validity today. It was a very forward-looking book, but then I guess when it got to the editors, they said, okay, where's the cookbook?
Well, editors aren't always forward-looking.
Well, a lot of it was that the editors in Washington had a very strong academic look at what they wanted to, and they had clear thoughts about what they thought the writers would find out in the fields. And so sometimes it was based on just like theory or something they read 2 million years ago. And then the writers were out there actually doing the legwork and not finding, for instance, what they thought they were supposed to find, or finding something much more interesting.
When we come back, we're going to talk more with Pat Willett about her wonderful book, America Eats. You can find out more about it, of course, on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTCAM.com and restaurantguysradio.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Frances Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, WCTCAM.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're having a fabulous discussion today with Pat Willard. Her book is America Eats. It's a collection of works that were originally collected for and by the Works Projects Administration in the Great Depression. They were never published, but now these stories are available to us. What prompted you to look for these stories and collect them in a book?
Well, it was two things. One, I was doing research for my last book, Secret of Saffron, and so I was reading a lot of academic culinary histories. And when I got to the American part of looking for saffron, I was reading a lot of these books, and every now and then there would be a mention of these papers. And the academics never really got into the stories, but they would every now and then just put in some interesting little line from the stories or parts of the story, and it just intrigued me. So I went down just on my own to the Library of Congress where I found them, and started reading through the papers, and what I realized was that the academics only got like a crumple of the story, that the true beauty of these stories were the actual writing, the stories that were so brought to life, these people on this time.
Well, you know, I also read in your book that the Works Projects Administration, the people who put this project together, definitely didn't want anyone who had written a cookbook to be one of the authors, which is amazing. And what you had was, like the photographers and the artists and the writers who were on other projects for the WPA, you got an amazing snapshot of an America.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's a fortuitous snapshot. And now, of course, Mark and I relate, and I think anybody who's listening to the show relates to looking at food and community as something they can offer a lot of insight on right. Where a country is. And this happened during the Great Depression, which was on the eve of World War II,
right.
Which is a snapshot of an America that was sort of, it was still there. You know, there were, you know, you point out in your book, there were still cowboys extant who'd cooked on wagon trains, and all people who'd cooked in ways that were already fading. And then, of course, after World War II, the American food landscape changed completely.
Right.
So, Frances, you're telling me it's a time when we were at war and we were in a Great Depression?
Yeah.
I don't know. Sounds a little bit familiar.
Well, but the thing is, after World War II, that's when we began to go to processed foods. This was still a time when you walked into the supermarket and mostly what you saw was apples and oatmeal and
right.
You know,
sugar and flour.
And the like. I mean...
Right. And, you know, even, we think about, you know, well, the people down the farms, they were eating, like, you know, you talk about localism now and, you know, Whole Foods. There were still, we were somewhat of a agrarian culture, but also city folks, they had, if you have old pictures of New York and a lot of the other great cities, there's the streets were lined with fresh produce. There was always a chicken house or, you know, somewhere you would go get your poultry and, you know, get it fresh. And so a lot of that was in place up until the end of World War II. So the papers just kind of, it's just such a fortuitous time for them to have done this, because as you said, there were still people who knew what it was like going across the prairies and Indians and things like that, and how our food came together, and it was right before things kind of went to hell in a handbasket kind of thing. You know? I mean, things were going to hell in a handbasket anyway at some point, but really after that it was, you know, we slipped.
So Pat, were some of these events that are happening, were they precursors to some of the events that happen now on some of these big holidays where a town will get together or a large group will get together?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're not that different, and I think that was the other cool thing that I found kind of going out in the road. I mean, the worst thing about us now is that we don't have the time to do it. There's so much hold on our time. So, especially with women being out to work, women were the ones who really kind of made sure that the community came together and organized everything. And now, you know, we're tired, you know, so we don't get together as much as we used to. But when we do, it's in the same way, and it's with the same thoughts behind it.
You know, there was a lot of work that went into making a lot of this food, but one of the things that I find, you know, of course this is a theme we return to on the show all the time, mm-hmm. is that food was a communal thing, and
right.
what food has become is so often, for so many of us, a solitary thing.
Yeah.
And certainly the preparation of food is no longer an integrated thing where, you know, a couple of women who live in the neighborhood would come together, or people trade pies and trade recipes and all that stuff. That's not really heard of anymore.
Except here's my one Pollyanna thing about that. I mean, I do hear more and more about it, especially with the younger generations, the 20s and 30s. They're getting together for many kinds of different meals and dinner parties. And I know up in the city here, there's several different what they call eating clubs, where people just get together and have basically a potluck dinner, but it's just things thrown in, or artists getting together and putting on these elaborate kind of performing arts kind of dinners. But I met a woman out in the road at the Iowa State Fair. Her mom was competing in the barbecue sauce episode, and she was telling me about how the one thing she regretted, and she grew up on a farm, the one thing that she really regretted was the fact that she doesn't have the time to get together anymore, but she and her friends and her neighborhood have gotten together, have made it a point of every other month, for instance, they would get together and make a certain dish. So one day, one time it will be like a huge pot of spaghetti sauce, and another time it will be like a big stew. And they hold to it religiously because it's the only time that they kind of like do get to see each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those little things are, they're certainly not as institutionalized as they were in the 30s, but we still kind of think they're a good way to get together. And I mean, I can't verify it, but it's something that is unique to our culture.
Well, you know, I do recommend the book to our listeners. It's called America Eats, and Pat Willard's the author. Now, you do have recipes in here.
Yes.
What would you think would be recipes that you'd be most excited to have and would suggest people should pick up your book because they need to make something that you wouldn't really see today that you found in your research?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm real partial to the beaten biscuits. I think we need to make more biscuits in our life. And the crawfish bisque recipe, which is a really, there's tons of recipes for crawfish bisque, but this is a true Creole recipe. And you have to, the kind of cool thing about it is that it's not given in typical recipe format. It's the writer writing about this woman talks you through making it.
Well, if you would like someone to talk you through making it, and Pat, with your permission, we're going to put that recipe up on our website, if that's all right with you.
Oh, that'd be so cool.
Great. Well, we're going to do that. You can find the recipe on restaurantguysradio.com. You can also go buy the book for yourself. It's more than a collection of recipes. It's a great bunch of stories, and you've done tremendous work putting it together. Pat, thanks for coming on our show.
Thanks so much, Pat.
Bye, guys.
It's wonderful to have you. Hey, listen, don't leave us. We'll be back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTCAM.com and restaurantguysradio.com.
Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa?
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
It's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport. There's a direct train from New Brunswick and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website, ask for the Restaurant Guys promo, or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you know, earlier in the show, Pat was talking about how groups would come together, different groups from with different backgrounds would come together at some of these festivals or events. And what they would do is they would each bring something from their culture from the items that were around them, and I thought that was fascinating. And it reminded me of something we used to do on Christmas Eve. After the restaurants would close, we would have a party. You know, and some of the regulars would participate, some of the staff members would participate. And what we would do during that party is everybody would bring something from the traditional Christmas dish of their heritage, whether it was lasagna or latkes or what have you. And it was really interesting to see all the different cultures, how they celebrated that particular holiday. And I think it was a real learning experience for the different cultures, seeing what each culture did for that particular event.
Well, and, you know, the restaurant staff itself, and we hire a lot of young people who aren't necessarily restaurant professionals when they first join us, but become that over time. And it's interesting to see people who may not be exposed to a lot of different cultures except in a restaurant setting where they go in as customers. And, you know, we have cooks and dishwashers and waiters from a bunch of different countries. And, mm-hmm. you know, very often the cooks in the kitchen will cook us for family meal because, you mm-hmm. know, in the restaurant we sit down and have a family meal. The whole staff sits down for half an hour. We talk about what's going to happen in the evening. We joke around a little bit. And the kitchen cooks a family-style meal for the entire staff to eat because we're there for a long period of time and you really only get one break in the restaurant business. And, you know, the Filipino, we had a great Filipino sous chef for a while mm-hmm. who just was a genius and introduced me to Filipino foods
sure.
I had no
sure.
knowledge
Sure, there were
of.
Lots of foods that we
but
saw.
There's but in our restaurant careers, we've had Oaxacan, people from Oaxaca, different other regions of Mexico, Haiti.
France. I mean,
yeah.
Spain. All different parts of the world, you would see all different types of cultures and all different types of cuisines. And I do think it's fascinating, and I really love to see the holiday cuisines of all these different cultures. That to me, that was always the most fascinating because basically every culture has some kind of holiday cuisine,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
is different than their everyday cuisine or some kind of extrapolation of their everyday cuisine. And it was always really fascinating to bring all those people together and see the surprise and amazement as you tried somebody else's, you know, pickled herring.
You know, I think that's interesting. And in a restaurant setting, we try and do that. And especially in a place like New York where it's so cosmopolitan, you really can do that. I'm reminded of Floyd Cardos, who's a friend who mm-hmm. was on the show a couple of times. And he's at restaurant Tabla in New York City.
New York City, right. On Madison Park.
And he is from Goa, which is the Portuguese region of India. And he cooks sort of Indian fusion food. By fusion, I mean it's based in the Goan tradition, but it also takes influences from the rest of Italy and from the rest of India and from the United States. And it And it's amazing.
Italian Indian. You created a new cuisine.
We haven't done that yet. But what's great for me is I got the great pleasure early on after we met Floyd. I went to a dinner he did. There was an Indian winemaker who's actually making wine in India who also came on the show. And they invited you and I, and you had to stay home, but they invited us to have dinner at the restaurant. And I got to sit down with Floyd in his restaurant where he's the executive chef and talk and the winemaker. And that was the one table. You know, there were like nine tables, and I was sitting with the winemaker and the chef while he served his own food. It's really amazing. It's an amazing privilege that we have in the business to be able to sit with a chef as important like that, and talk about the food as it comes. And it's a very similar kind of thing. It's a cultural exchange, and I think that's what we all seek. So invite somebody over your house, make a traditional dish, and ask them to make one as well.
And have a cultural exchange.
I hope that you've enjoyed the last hour with the Restaurant Guys. I know that we certainly did. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC AM, and the RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Check it out.